From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today's program talking about Illinois prisons. There have been a number of developments in recent months, a report detailing billions of dollars in infrastructure needs, the dismissal of a longstanding lawsuit aimed at improving mental health care for incarcerated people, and the continuation of a push to improve health care in general in Illinois prisons. And all this comes against a backdrop of a prison population that has shrunk significantly in the past decade, from a high of greater than 48,000 men and women a decade ago to a present level around 30,000. And yet, despite that significant downsizing in the population, the state has not closed any major facilities in that time. Joining us to talk about all of this is Jennifer Volen-Katz, who's executive director of the prison monitoring group, the John Howard Association. Jennifer, thanks for being back on the program. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us is David Olson, who is a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology, also co-director of the Center for Criminal Justice Research at Loyola University, Chicago. David, welcome back to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Also with us is Harold Hirschman, who is an attorney with the firm Dentons. He has worked on these lawsuits challenging the Illinois Department of Corrections on its mental health care and health care for people who are incarcerated there. He's here to talk about that aspect of what's been happening. Harold Hirschman, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And finally, Alan Mills is an attorney with the Uptown People's Law Center, which is a public interest law firm that has represented many people in the Illinois Department of Corrections seeking to improve conditions and life for people there. Alan Mills, welcome to the program to you as well. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Listeners, I should also add, we invited the Illinois Department of Corrections to join us, as well as the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. That's the labor union that represents thousands of workers at the Department of Corrections. I should add, it was just before the Thanksgiving break. They both responded and said no one would be able to join us for today's show. But you can join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right. Alan Mills, I want to begin with you. Can you just talk about the scope of the mental health problem that people face in Illinois prisons?
Sure. I like to think of it as a twofold problem. First of all, we have people who enter the system who have previously been diagnosed or previously have some mental health concerns, whether they've been diagnosed or not. And second of all, the group of people who develop those mental health conditions after they've been admitted to prison or to jail. Many people have recognized that prisons are fairly toxic from a mental health standpoint. And therefore it's not surprising that people either get worse or deteriorate to the point where they have a mental illness at the beginning. When we started this case, the Department of Corrections vastly undercounted the number of people who had diagnosed with a mental illness in the Department of Corrections. I still think they're somewhat undercounting, but at least as of now, they admit that I believe it's a third. Harold can correct me if I'm wrong. At least a third of the population is seriously mentally ill, and about half of it has some sort of mental health condition that requires some sort of treatment or tracking by mental health professionals.
Seriously mentally ill, a third, and that is a term of art. Harold Hirschman, talk about that, or maybe you can just take us back to how the case, it's known as Rasho for one of the plaintiffs. How did that come about?
Rasho was a prisoner, and he, on his own, filed a class action in the Central District. Judge Baker, who had handled multitudes of prisoner cases, did not believe that a prisoner should be running a class action, and so he recruited Mark Kadish from Mayor Brown. Mark recruited Alan. I was already working with Equip for Equality to bring such a case, and that was the team that has represented the mentally ill until Judge Mim decided that he didn't have jurisdiction a month ago.
And I do want to come back to what happened a month ago, but briefly, what talk about how that case developed. And I know there were a lot of twists and turns over the years. Ultimately, the state conceded that there was a problem. Can you briefly talk about that, the consent decree?
Sure. When the lawyers got into the case, the department was quite amenable to looking at their situation. And a guy named Fred Cohn, who had a significant reputation in terms of analysis of prison conditions, was hired, and he issued a report. And the report essentially said, too few professionals, too many sick people. Here's a 5-year plan to try to fix things. And we then tried to negotiate a settlement agreement, but as the politics of Illinois changed, so did the willingness of the department to address these problems. And we had been working on a settlement like others where experts would pick what the solution was. And then the attorney general said, oh, no, we can't settle that. We can't settle that way. We've got to have exact numbers. And so we went back to the drawing board, hired another expert jointly to work on the exact numbers. And finally, we're now rolling towards Rahner time. The department said, oh, no, we're not going to sign a consent decree. And so we were faced and we said, okay, we'll litigate. We're on the trial call. We're due to go to trial in January of 2016, I think. And the department says, oh, no, we want to settle. And so we created a settlement agreement, and it was supposed to be a consent decree. But the Rahner administration said, we don't like consent decrees. We're not going to sign a consent decree. And so we signed an agreement about making changes. And some of those changes have actually been implemented, although it's ironic. For instance, one of the things that we had been pushing for a long time was a hospital, and they agreed to build a hospital, and they built a hospital. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a staff. So we have a magnificent building that $50 million was spent on that has 150 beds, of which maybe 30 are filled. And we went along under the settlement agreement until the Court of Appeals in February of 2022 said, oh, you have to have a consent decree, and you don't have a consent decree, which was no surprise to anybody. And so we went back and forth to try to create a consent decree. That didn't work. And so the parties, the department and us, agreed to go back to trial. And that's where we were, and that's what we spent the last year and a half doing, until Judge Mim woke up one morning and said, gee, I don't think I have jurisdiction, even though he'd been on the judge on the case for something like 15 years.
Yeah. Okay. Let me put a pin in that. And I do want to come back to that point in a moment. But Jennifer Vollenkatz, I want to bring you into the conversation. You've been waiting patiently. So from the perspective of a prison monitor, somebody who's visited prisons, you work with people who visit the prisons and assess conditions there. You get to hear from incarcerated people, often, I think, out of the earshot of officials. You certainly get a lot of correspondence from incarcerated people. What has the lack of treatment, and maybe some of these, you know, steps we have seen taken as a result of the Ratio case, what has that achieved? What has it been like in the prisons?
So what we routinely see in the prisons and hear from the people who are incarcerated, as well as from the people that work inside the prisons, is that there's a significant number of people who suffer from significant mental health issues, and they continue to suffer with those issues. There's not enough staff to provide treatment. The kind of treatment they're providing isn't helping the people who are struggling with their mental health issues. They're just not getting the care that they need, quite frankly. And that comes through in a variety of different ways. Sometimes it's seeing people who are actively in mental health crisis, and other times it's hearing from people, you know, that they very much want to be getting care and treatment that they're not receiving, that they used to take medication for a mental health issue and they no longer receive it, and they talk about the consequences of that for them. The staff talk about what it's like to work with people who are suffering from mental health issues and not getting the treatment they need, the relief they need. And it's hugely problematic. And, you know, to Harold's point, I've been in that unbelievable new $150 million facility, the Joliet Inpatient Treatment Center that Illinois built, in response to this litigation. And it is state of the art. It is unlike anything we have in this state, quite frankly, both in terms of being designed for mental health treatment as well as medical care. I mean, there are state-of-the-art medical care equipment, and it is also designed to help people in a variety of different mental health and medical crises. And to see that go unused because we cannot find people to work there, I think just really hones in on the point that if you cannot find people to treat people with mental health issues in prisons, you have to go about this differently. Then those people who cannot receive the care they need to be somewhere where they can receive that care.
And David Olson from Loyola University, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this aspect of our conversation today. I asked you to be here more for the sort of the numbers conversation we're getting to a little later, but certainly it's a truism that people who are in, most people in the Department of Corrections will be back among us someday, right? And so there are consequences to not giving people the treatment that might benefit them at the time they are incarcerated.
Yeah, I think part of it's also recognizing that the way that we view prisons and the purposes of prisons has changed dramatically over the last 40 to 50 years. The way prisons were designed, the location where prisons were built, was specifically focused on the ideas of incapacitation and punishment. There was never a focus on providing therapeutic interventions and nothing along the lines that those individuals with severe mental illness need. So I think part of the challenge is the system was built a long time ago with one purpose in mind, and now it's having to reckon with how do we address these other purposes, specifically with respect to the treatment of the mentally ill in facilities that are not built for that and aren't in locations for that. To everybody's point, the Joliet Treatment Center was intended to be the solution to that, but even there, they're having struggles finding adequate staffing.
Even in Joliet, which is in the Chicagoland area, I guess, right. At least I would say it is, which is, you know, makes it, you can imagine how much harder it is to find mental health professionals in some of the very rural places where Illinois prisons are also located. All right, Harold Hirschman, I want to bring you back now because we've been sort of building up to, without necessarily, you know, for an audience that is not a law school symposium on this, what exactly did the judge decide that made such a sudden change and resulted in the dismissal of this case, which I haven't heard from anyone who saw this coming. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Well, none of us saw it coming because this was a creation of the judge himself. One day we just got an order saying, tell me why you think I still have jurisdiction. And he really didn't explain what the issue was. He just had laid that question out. And, you know, we had a real simple answer. We had an agreement with the other side. And part of that agreement was if we had hit a bump in the road and weren't fixing the problem, we could go back to the trial call. And we jointly filed an order with him, which he signed, which said, okay, if the consent decree is over, we go back to the trial call. And the day before the consent decree was over, he sent it to the trial call. So he had jurisdiction. And we then went about doing precisely what the party said we would do, which is get ready for a trial. And then all of a sudden, we get this order saying, ooh, I don't think I have jurisdiction. And you know, I said to him, and it's on the record, so I'll repeat it. Look, Judge, you had a simple contract issue. and you turned it in to the civil procedure examination from hell. And it still is a simple contract issue in my book. We filed a motion for him to vacate his judgment, and that's pending. Interestingly, the other side agrees with us that he made a serious error because he had the settlement starting a year earlier than it did by its terms. And he made a further error of law by not following a case called Doe, which says the parties can extend the terms of a settlement agreement if they agree, and we did.
All right, we need to pause in our conversation. I do want to note the Department of Corrections could not join us for this conversation, but they did previously issue a statement to our partner station, WGLT, Bloomington Normal, which covered this case about a month ago, and said, a spokesperson for the Department of Corrections said, the court's recent indication it will dismiss the rational litigation will not change the services being provided to the mentally ill population within the Illinois Department of Corrections. The department will continue to serve its mentally ill population and remains committed to meeting its goals without the need for court oversight. But of course, people with serious mental illness is only one aspect of where advocates say the Department of Corrections is failing to meet the needs of incarcerated people in Illinois. And we're going to talk about that when we come back here on the 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are spending the first part of our program today talking about the Illinois prison system, the Illinois Department of Corrections, specifically health care and mental health care for people who are incarcerated in Illinois. We've been talking about this with Harold Hirschman, who's an attorney. He's with the law firm Dentons and has long been involved in litigation aimed at improving those areas within the Department of Corrections. We're also speaking with Jennifer Vollen-Katz, executive director of the Illinois Prison Monitoring Group called the John Howard Association. Also with us, David Olson, Dr. David Olson, professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology and co-director of the Center for Criminal Justice Research at Loyola University in Chicago, and Alan Mills with the Uptown People's Law Center, a public interest law firm that's also been involved in litigation aimed at improving healthcare, mental health care, and life in general in Illinois prisons. And Alan, I want to move on now to the healthcare issue in prisons. Talk briefly about what it is like to get sick, to have to face an illness if you are incarcerated in Illinois.
It's horrible. You're not going to get treatment is the bottom line. And I think the other thing that's really important to understand, though, is that this sort of goes back to what Dave was saying. When prisons were built, the sort of target population was the 18 to 25 year olds. But we've changed dramatically the makeup of the prisons because of truth in sentencing, because of long sentences they're given out, because of life without parole. Our prison system is, our prisoners are aging. So not only do you have the sort of normal, as it were, injuries that people get, but you're dealing with old age in prison. And prisons were certainly never designed to be nursing homes or to be intensive care hospitals or any of those kinds of things. But today they have to play that role. We're increasingly seeing people diagnosed with dementia, diagnosed with cancer, diagnosed with the other sorts of diseases, which on the outside will end you in a nursing home or in an assisted care facility for years on end. In prison, you generally are still in your cell with those debilitating conditions. And you're lucky if you see a doctor regularly at all. And the quality of the care you get is terrible. There are not enough doctors. Several prisons don't have a full-time doctor at all. Even places that have 2,000 or 3,000 prisoners may rely on a part-time doctor. So if you're in prison, you're in bad shape. But if you're in prison, you get sick, you should just cross your fingers and hope you don't end up getting a debilitating condition or worse yet, dying. And unfortunately, the federal court monitors have found that there are lots and lots of things that happen to people who are on the way out of their end of life, which either cause the death or certainly make things a lot worse at the end of life. So it is a system which inflicts totally unnecessary pain on thousands of people every single year.
And Jennifer Vollenkatz, I wanted to also ask you, there are, I mentioned about 30,000 people in the Illinois prison system. I think it's about 1,400 of them are women. Do you hear specifically, are there healthcare challenges that, I mean, obviously women face unique healthcare circumstances in the prisons. Do you hear specifically about the healthcare conditions for the women in Decatur and Logan Correctional Centers?
We do. And certainly women suffer uniquely in terms of medical care in the Illinois prisons due to certain things that women experience that men do not, such as pregnancy and childbirth. You know, there are certainly changes that have been made to policy, and, you know, no prison system wants to have pregnant women, frankly, or women who are giving birth in their custody, but they often don't have the opportunity to say no to that. And, you know, we've met women who've given birth in their cells when staff just don't respond quickly enough. So absolutely, there are unique challenges when it comes to the physical and medical care of women who are incarcerated. You know, there has been work being done to improve the availability of menstrual products for women in prison for years now, whether it's making more pads and tampons available to women or higher quality, and also asking staff to respect that when women are menstruating, a strip search is inappropriate. I mean, there are many stories of women who have had to sit without any kind of sanitary protection and bleed, frankly, all over their clothing. So there's absolutely unique challenges that come with being a woman who's incarcerated when it comes to medical care. But there was something else I wanted to add to what Alan just said, which sure. is not only is there not appropriate care for dementia and other issues that plague most people when they're aging, frankly, and certainly the population of people in prison is not immune to that. Our prisons were also not built to be compliant with the American with Disabilities Act. And so that means that people who are in wheelchairs, people who use walkers, people that need support for hearing or things of that nature often go without. And while they are supposed to be accommodated to have those needs met while they are in prison, the reality is we meet people all the time in prison who are not having those needs accommodated. And so it's difficult for anybody who has any kind of disability, but particularly as people age, it becomes even more challenging.
Harold Hirschman, I know you've been involved in some of the legal efforts. I think Lippert is the name of that case, if memory serves, aimed at improving healthcare in the prisons. What is the state of that case?
Well, that case, we do have a consent decree, and the department and the governor promised to do certain things against a certain timetable. For instance, the simplest thing, electronic medical records. In 2006, the state studied it and came to the conclusion that they had to have electronic medical records in order to deliver care. In 2010, the department contracted with Wexford, their present physical and mental health vendor, to set up a system. When we settled Lippert in a consent decree, there were no electronic medical records except in the women's prison. They agreed to have a contract by 2019. They actually had a contract by 2019. There still are no electronic medical records because they canceled that contract. And they never explained to the court or anybody else why they canceled the contract, including the vendor. So there's a thing that everybody agrees is absolutely critical to delivering physical health care to the 30,000 prisoners. And they still don't have it. Now, Texas, for instance, realized in the 1990s that they needed electronic records. And one of the things they did was they tracked how many people they were sending outside. Because if you send a prisoner outside for medical care, not only do you send that prisoner, but you send two guards with him. So it is a very manpower consuming process to send somebody. So Texas said, gee, how many of these do we have? And then, so that's what they used the system for the, in the first place. And then how many can we do by telemedicine so that we don't have to send them out? Well, Illinois still 20 some odd years later doesn't answer the first question and doesn't answer the second question. So there are fixes beyond the awfulness that might mitigate some of this. The Lippert Monitor's report is due out this month, or very early next month. And I'm afraid it's going to say, as it has said over the last 5 years, the department is failing. It is not doing what it promised.
Not doing what it's promised. And yet the department has seen a significant decline in the population in the past decade. I think it peaked around 48,000 in 2013. It's now around 30,000. And this brings us to the final thing I wanted to talk about today. And David Olson, I want to come to you for this, which is, I mean, some years ago, when just when the prison population was starting its decline, you and I spoke about what it would take to actually have the state of Illinois consider closing some facilities. That hasn't happened. Can you talk through how that might work hypothetically if, I suppose, if politics and economic development were not considerations for Illinois Department of Corrections?
Well, you've eliminated the two biggest challenges, right? The economic and political considerations. I think, like the point I made earlier, the prison population's down as much as it is, primarily because we view the use of prisons differently than we did, 15 or 20 years ago. And I think it's wrapped up in all the themes that we've touched on here. People are being sentenced to prison now for more serious crimes that carry longer sentences. The people who are convicted of less serious crimes are being increasingly sentenced to supervision in the community. And that may be where most people are getting access to needed treatment services. And so we're at a place now where we've got the prisons are below their capacity. There was always talk about at what point could Illinois close a prison. And there was always, at least in most people's mind, a numeric threshold that it couldn't be done until the prison population got below a certain level to address the crowding situation. And I think we're at that point now, right? As you pointed out, the prison population has been hovering around 30,000. I think the system's designed to hold 36,000. But we've
although
now
the department says its capacity is 43,000, what they call operational capacity.
Yeah.
Of course, that's probably an inhumane level of stacking in some cases. Yeah.
Yeah, it's putting people in two cells when really putting one person in a cell is more appropriate. So I think the challenge now is there's a lot of facilities that are extremely dated. The report that you mentioned previously cited a long list of capital needs that the department has. And so there's the question of, okay, if we're going to make investments in the conditions of the prisons, what should those investments look like? Again, given all the things that have been raised here, the issues about the needs of the population, the changing composition of the population. But we have to recognize also that these decisions do come with political and economic considerations. Some of the oldest prisons in the state have essentially had communities built around them for close to 100 years. And so the local community has been built up around these facilities, become reliant on these facilities for economic activity and for employment opportunities. So those things need to be taken into consideration as well when the state starts figuring out where's the investment going to be made in the facilities. To that point, though, it still comes down to if we reimagine what prisons are going to look like and how they're going to operate, can we attract the workforce that's needed to working in these environments that have the necessary background? So all the conditions that have been raised in the consent decrees and agreements rely on having a professional staff available to deliver the kinds of services needed. And as you pointed out, even in a community like Joliet, which was picked primarily because of its proximity to a large metropolitan area and workforce, is still struggling to fill those types of positions.
Alan Mills, do you want to weigh in on this? And maybe I can just mention, I'm not going to play the clip. I did ask Governor Pritzker about this in an interview back in August. You can find it on our website, 21stshow.org. But he said, you know, it may not be a question of closing facilities, because if you have fewer people incarcerated in the same number of facilities, you may be able to do better things overall. But Alan Mills, I know you want to weigh in on this. So please go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say is, you know, the report that they've referred to identifies five prisons which are currently not functional according to the physical plan. And two of those, I think, are particularly problematic for different reasons. Pontiac Correctional Center, which is one of our ancient pre-1920 facilities, which is used mostly as a maximum security prison, is already two-thirds empty. The medium security unit was closed entirely, and they're in the process of closing one of the two big cell houses. And what's mostly left there are people with serious mental illness. And everybody since we've started working on these mental health cases have said Pontiac is not an appropriate facility for seriously mental ill people. It is not set up to provide mental health care. It's falling apart, and it's mostly closed. So there's a real question in my mind, why in the world we want to invest a lot more money in Pontiac when I think everybody agrees we'd be better off elsewhere. And it's one of those prisons that has a horrible time staffing. Last numbers we were given, they had about 50% vacancies in mental health care people, but also in guards. And therefore, they couldn't even move people to get mental health care. The other one is Logan. And Logan has also got some very serious physical issues in terms of replacing all kinds of things. There were people waiting around in sewage last year. Literally waiting in sewage in one of the housing units, and there have been many problems at Logan for many years. The women's population is largely not very serious crimes that we talked about in terms of the men's population. Many of those folks could simply go home or could go into work release or other lower security facilities. But I think even more tellingly about Logan is it has a long history of tolerating sexual abuse and even in many ways encouraging sexual abuse. There have been several different cases brought, including one by us, where either guards or other prisoners had raped female prisoners there. It is a place with a toxic culture and simply should be closed and everybody reduced in their security levels, and many of them either sent home or put on electronic monitoring or into work. Mm-hmm. Work camps.
Well, just about 1 minute left, even a little less than that in our time together. Jennifer Vollenkatz, if you want to get the last word in here, I think this is a situation that can leave people feeling kind of hopeless hearing this. I don't know if you have advice for everyday Illinoisans if they want to try and make a difference here, or just final thoughts on what we've been talking about.
Thanks. What I would say is, I think that what's become very clear is what we have going on in the state of Illinois in terms of our prisons are two challenges and an opportunity. The challenges are the physical infrastructure of our prisons. The CGL report we've all been talking about estimates at least $2.5 billion needed in physical plant maintenance and repair and replacement costs.
And maybe you can just skip to the opportunity super briefly, because we're
okay. Low prison population. Low prison population. We've got prisons that are falling down, hard to staff, but we've got a low population, which
so
really opens
up.
Yeah,
this is a time to make change. All right, I'm sorry to cut you off. Thank you so much for being with us, Jennifer Vollenkatz, David Olson, Harold Hirschman, and Alan Mills. Interesting conversation. We will continue to follow this issue in the months ahead. More to come here on the 21st Show after a short break. Do please stay with us.